Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Ruth L. Schwartz. Ruth L. Schwartz is the author of four award-winning books of poetry and a memoir: Dear Good Naked Morning, published by Autumn House, 2005, Edgewater, selected by Jane Hirschfield as a 2001 National Poetry Series winner, HarperCollins 2002, Singular Bodies, winner of the 2000 Anhinga Prize for Poetry, Accordion Breathing and Dancing, University of Pittsburgh Press, 1996, winner of the 1994 Associated Writing Programs Award, and Death in Reverse, A Love Story, Michigan State University Press, 2004. For many years, Schwartz made her living as a public health educator, trainer, and consultant specializing in AIDS and cancer. She is currently a practitioner of a psycho-spiritual healing modality called heart-mind integration and lives in Oakland, California. She's on the faculty of the Low Residency MFA program at Ashland University. Hi, Ruth. How you doing?
Hi, Jan. It's nice to be here.
It's good to see you. We were talking, we haven't seen each other for a number of years, and you've had so much success. It's really good to have you here.
Oh, thank you.
So you're going to start with some poems from Dear Good Naked Morning.
Yeah. I thought I'd start with a poem called Music for Guitar and Stone. And I write a lot about music. I'm not a musician, but music really moves me. And one of the things I like to say about this poem is that there's a certain thing that's very moving about seeing a very accomplished musician play a very hard piece and make it look easy. But I also find it moving to watch someone who is more of a student musician play a really hard piece, and you can tell how hard it is. So this poem takes off from that. Music for Guitar and Stone. In music, I can love the small failures, the ones which show how difficult it is. The young guitarist's fingers slipping for an instant from their climb of chords. He sits alone on the stage, bright light, one leg wedged up on a step, his raised knee round and tender, and the notes like birds from a vanishing flock, each one more exquisite and lonely, the fingers part of the hand, yet separate from the hand, each living muscle married to the whole. In life, the failures feel like they'll kill me, or you will, or we'll kill each other. It's so hard to feel the music moving through us, the larger patterns of river and mountain, where damage is not separate from creation, transformation, where every mistake we make can wash smooth and clean as stones in water, then land on shore, then be thrown in again. I want to sleep like a stone for 1,000 years. I want to wake with creatures traced smooth on my skin. I want to forget I loved you and failed you as you failed and loved me too in the lengthy, painful evolution of our kind. I want to sleep for 1,000 years, then wake up in some other world where failure is part of the music and seen to make it more beautiful, where the fingers forgive each other, where we can sit naked again at the window, watch the notes fly by like birds who have finally found their way home. And there's a lot of loss and difficulty in this book, a fair amount of failures and mistakes and some brutality. And I think one thing I come back to again and again as a poet is looking for moments or instants of redemption wherever I can find them. I'll read two poems together that are sort of companion pieces in a way. This one is called Photograph of the Child. Your mouth is open as a world. The skin on your arms is soft as the flowering world. You're jumping barefoot in the grass. No one is stopping you. No one and nothing has destroyed you yet. Your skinny little belly, its navel an off-center planet. Your shorts bunched up, your little knees uneven with the jump. Only your toes are touching, your heels have already leapt. I will frame you like this forever before and after I abandon you. And who's alive who doesn't remember floating at least once above the ordinary street? And who's never made a promise they couldn't keep? And this next poem, the reason why I called it a companion piece is it's sort of a portrait of the same person who was in that photograph years later, and my process of trying to look at the two images. This is called Mud Season. And I wrote this before I actually had viscerally, personally experienced a mud season, but a few years later I moved onto a dirt road, and perhaps some listeners know what mud season is like. God made the mud, and now she has to crawl in it. She's not the only one. Dolores, for example, with her matted hair, her pushed-up breasts, pills to take the fear away, men who pay her by the hour, God on her belly in the muck, God on her knees. When nothing has yet become what it will become, when no astonishment of green has yet unfurled, when pain feels larger than our lives, nothing has yet become what it will become. Who wouldn't choose a different season if they had a choice? I lie down in the dark and listen to my heart, that circling helix in the chest. Apart from me, apart from love, apart from even the question of love, original, pulsing, unscarred. And I'll read another poem that has some music in it. As I said, a lot of my work is attempting to come to terms with both how we get damaged and how we go on. So this is called Love Poem for the Past. Because your stories flare open like bullets, because you drink like your father, betray like your mother, because you still attack as you were attacked, because you shot the soft brown birds, because he gave you the gun and he was your father, because you want to kill him for that, to kill the place he lives in you, to break his human neck, because I kiss your human neck, your downy shoulder blades, charred stubs of wings. Why have we been brought here, the music asks, but it taps a cymbal as it asks, plays a little riff on the asking, and I know someone somewhere is slowly dancing, not to answer, but only to honor the question. The music shrugs and goes on playing, shrugs and shivers a little, swings and sways a little in its play. It brought us here and goes on bringing such faith in it, such opened body of sound. Each note is a stone laid down. The stones make a path. Each path is made of many stones and leads nowhere. But there is joy in stones which follow each other like this, joy in notes which coax and stroke and hope and pluck such music from their veins.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Ruth L. Schwartz. I want to ask you about what you've mentioned already, which is, writing about the difficult. And I really love how in your work you don't shy away from the difficult. Does that have something to do with how you originally came to poetry, writing about difficult things?
I think my very first impulse in poetry was to praise. The first poem I ever remember writing was an ode. It was an ode to a raccoon. So I think my first impulse was to praise and to love the world. But as I got a little older, I started to see how many things in the world were really difficult to love. Mm-hmm. And since then, I've still been trying to love the world. And the poems have helped me embrace the complex and challenging act of doing that.
Mm-hmm. Do you still have the Ode to Raccoon poem?
somewhere I do, in a file folder somewhere. I know that it started out, "Hey there, little masked one."
I'd like to hear that one.
I didn't bring it, sorry.
Okay. You talk about looking for redemption in the difficult poems. You know, what if you find yourself working on a poem and not finding that redemption arising organically? Do you paste it in there? Or, how do you handle that? You know, if it just doesn't seem to be coming.
Probably mostly those are poems I put away. I mean, I might have tried sometimes to force it in there, but that's not going to feel satisfying. And I think a poem that has none of it isn't going to feel satisfying either. But I don't, by redemption, I don't mean a happy ending.
Right.
I mean, obviously lots of these poems don't have happy endings, but there needs for me to be at least a glint or a glimmer, even if it just comes through an image of something that opens out.
Okay, I see. So it just might be an image, a small light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. You know, although there are those moments in life where there is no small glimmer, and so yet as a writer, you're choosing not to include those moments, or
this is tough. You know, I think that my answer to that in a way is vision. I think there is still a way. I have this belief that I need to look unflinchingly at everything. I don't know why I think I need to do that, but I seem to be quite convinced that I do. And I find that if I look closely enough at almost anything, there is a kind of beauty in it, mm-hmm. even if the beauty is along with what is ugly.
I see. Okay. That helps. Can you read some more poems?
Sure. I thought I'd try to read something which is a little bit lighter. Light poems are not my specialty, but I used to drive a lot to commute back and forth to a job, and I would see a lot of things along the highway, including cows, and this is a poem called Grass. I was gratified recently to have a dairy farmer tell me that the poem was very accurate. Grass. Yesterday and the day before that, the cows ate grass. Tomorrow and the next, and every day after that, the cows will eat grass. They'll eat until they can't stand up, and even then collapsed upon the earth in their last hours, if they can reach it with their mouths, they'll eat grass. They'll eat until they've eaten it all, until there are only a few stray blades halfway buried under boulders. Then they'll nudge aside the boulders with their large and knowing lips, and eat that grass too. Only the smallest calves today, the ones no bigger than dogs, are lying down. They gaze out onto the landscape like dreamers, the sky marbled with fatty clouds, the cherry trees beginning to leaf, the first few poppies unfurling their cadmium banners, the fences making some things possible and others difficult, the shadows falling from and following each thing. And the world seems so strange, so common and wondrous at once, that the calves ask the cows eating grass, "Is this all there is?" And the answer comes back from mouths full of grass, "This is all there is." So I thought I'd try to read another one which maybe addresses some of what we were talking about I don't know, perhaps not the question of redemption, but sort of how to look at everything and how to find beauty in everything. This is called Springtime in the Central Valley. Even the oldest trees are blooming, limbs growing down instead of up, producing a personal halo of fallen petals. Even the fat sheep bloom in the fields, their faces thick with unshorn wool, their coats springy as lettuces. Even the tractors bloom, pledged to churning dirt. The dented pickup in the grove, delirious with oranges. The waxy school bus, crayon yellow, child in each window, laughing like a star. Even the drivers of the cars open their pink mouths. The cows are blooming, great brown roses, egrets white like thorns between them. Animals die and bloom on the roads, revealing the plump burst plums of their organs. The living feed among the dead. The living feed upon the dead, murmuring, flashing scatter of flies, jeweled and diligent. Everything is perfect, each thing seems to say, with dead or living beak or finely jointed legs, intricate bristles of tail or sturdy teeth. The golden eagle says it from a branch. The milkweed seed with its slim brown propeller and dozens of filaments waving like arms. the silvery snow rust-dusted coats of the prairie dogs and the fox who hunts them. Everything says it, sighs it, chirps it, clicks and whistles, rustles, rests it into form, flaps and swoops and coos and hums it into form, squawks or caws or snorts it out, slimes it into algae puddles, flutters into wings, perches, dips, drips, and sails, trails awake like a vein through the water, nervy, improbable. Marry me over and over, says the world, offering sun on our shoulders, a mantle, a cloak of hands. So I have this obsession, as you can hear, with kind of looking at the world. And often I try to find the ways that the world reflects me and the ways that I reflect the world back. This is a poem called Fifth Street Love Poem. 1. There is a piano in the street. There is a man in white shirt and black blazer. He wears white gloves on his hands, saluting the street air. He plays as if our lives are beginning. He plays against the sunset bubble in each parking meter, time expired. There is a man with a long beard, colors of street and snow mixed together, colors of earth and fire. He is wearing a blue miniskirt. His legs and feet are bare. His calves are taut with muscle, thick with hair. Animal, intelligent, rippling as he lifts each foot, slow as prayer, then sets it down again. He is checking the coin return slots of the public telephones. Thoughtfully, he feels inside each one for the coins which aren't there, and then moves on, his bare toes curling over and into the street as if it were sand and could give way, even a little bit, beneath him. He looks like the first man walking on the first earth, feeling with his feet for the footholds, the thresholds, the intimate designs.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Ruth L. Schwartz. And she's reading from her new book, Dear Good Naked Morning. You know, you have a lot of the natural world and the world, the rest of the world in your books. But I'm wondering, you know, you have in your bio that you are a practitioner of psycho-spiritual healing, of a healing, psycho-spiritual healing modality called heart-mind integration. And I'm wondering if you see any sort of give and take or any kind of nourishment, nourishing relationship between that kind of work, which I don't really know what that is, heart-mind integration, maybe you could talk about that, and the work of writing poetry. Do you see it as those as companion things to do, or are they totally separate in your mind?
No, I think they're very related, and I think they really come from the same impulse in me. I mean, I love the world, and I love people, but I also am pained by much of what I see in the world. And I think for a long time I wrote poetry to try to grapple and wrestle with all that was so painful and devastating. And when I discovered this kind of work, I think it gave me something else to do with it. Not to reject it, but to try to bring some more peace and light to my little corner of the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of the poems I've written have to do with difficult, painful, intimate relationships. And at a certain point, I thought, you know, maybe these don't have to be quite so difficult and painful. And
the relationships or
yeah,
the poems?
The relationships.
Okay.
Okay. I got... there's only so many poems you can write about heartbreak. Or maybe not, but I felt like I had written my quota.
Okay.
And so I underwent some profound healing and learned to work with people in a way which I have found can also help people just untangle and untwist some of the knots inside of our beings. There's much that's difficult in the world that we can't change, but I have found that there are some things that we can change. There are some ways that we can make more peace within ourselves and in our close relationships, at least some of the time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, since you've been doing this work, have you noticed any kind of shift in your poems, in your work?
Yeah, I mostly stopped writing poetry.
Oh, don't say
actually.
That. Oh, no.
But I did write. I think the reason for that is that poetry for me really has come out of a sort of irritant. It's, you know, the proverbial grain of sand irritating the oyster, making the pearl. And for a long time, there was so much in the world that irritated me in that way that I kind of had to write poems in mm-hmm. order to grapple. Mm-hmm. And as I have reached a place of greater peace internally, I am less irritated in that way. I did write a very long poem last summer about a very difficult situation in my family, which was so challenging to me that I needed to come back to it in poetry. Mm-hmm. So I think poetry is still there for me in those moments when I most need it.
Hmm. Well, that's kind of tricky, though, because I want you to write more poems, but I don't want you to have all this irritation. So yeah, I guess you'll figure that out. But
I guess for me, what really matters is the creative impulse. I personally don't care that much if I continue to write poems or not, because I feel like I use the same skills very much in my work with clients. Mm-hmm. For me, the work of healing has so much to do with image and metaphor. Mm-hmm. It's such a powerful part of what I do, and kind of being able to go into those places with people. It's really the same kind of movement for me as going into these places with my poems.
Okay. Well, we care if you write more poems, but can you read some more?
Sure. Let's see. Well, I can read one of those difficult relationship poems, I suppose, if you want. This is called Tener. I remember the note in which I told you that our love had come to feel untenable to me. Untenable. It comes from the same Latin root as the Spanish tener, to have. Tengo, I have. Tendré, I will have. Tuve, I had. It's profoundly irregular. I watch two spiders on a trellis, rising and falling on their own threads. I listen to voices behind me, murmurs too soft to have meaning, and then the scraping of chairs on cement. The lake is calm and still, the boaters have gone home, the clouds mount between and behind the mountains, waiting to be subsumed by the body of night. A small tree trembles a little down by the water. I remember how hard I wanted, how hard you wanted, how hard that hardness was between us, like a rib or shin. The hammock sways in the late breeze, its shadows climb the railing a little, then stop to consider the mixing of light into dark. Each leaf on the tree above it has a shadow leaf, a twin, a doppelganger, an alternate self, which is, in this moment, alive on the wood and held and swaying a little. Each one looks something like a heart, pinched between two fingers and made to dance. There wasn't love to be mined from that place, that hard bone. But at times a bird swooped from one chest into the other's flesh. Underneath what I wanted then is a more faithful layer of want, steady, sustaining, a bridge. One day, naked alone in bed, I feel it, palm on my own animal belly, as if there were something for me to glean from myself. Beneath the lake are bricks from an abandoned city. What's left under the bricks is skin and everything it knew before the flood. And I'll read a short poem. I used to live in the Central Valley of California, where much of the food for the country is grown. And this is a poem about driving past many, many, many citrus trees with a scent so strong that it came through the closed car window. It's called Tangerine. It was a flower once. It was one of a billion flowers whose perfume broke through closed car windows, forced a blessing on their drivers. Then what stayed behind grew swollen, as we do, grew juice instead of tears, and small, hard, sour seeds, each one bitter as we are and filled with possibility. Now a hole opens up in its skin where it was torn from the branch. Ripeness can't stop itself, breathes out. We can't stop it either. We breathe in. I thought I'd read a little bit from my previous book, Edgewater. I write a lot about animals. I love observing animals. This is a dog poem. It's called Fetch. Nothing is ever too hard for a dog, all big, dumb happiness and effort. This one keeps swimming out into the icy water for a stick. He'd do it all day and all night if you'd throw it that long. He'd do it till it killed him, then he'd die, dripping and shining, a black waterfall, the soggy, broken stick still clenched in his doggy teeth. And watching him, you want to cry for all the wanting you've forsworn, and how, when he hits deeper water, his body surges suddenly as if to say, nothing could stop me now. While you're still thinking everything you've ever loved meant giving up some other thing you loved, your hand, the stick, stuck in the air, in the shining air. This is a true story about my cat. I did not get his permission, however, to read it. It's called This Is Life. Death is small, but it smells big. The mouse, crushed and decomposing, gift left by the cat in the center of the bed, pooling in its rotten juice, filling the room with its blood scent. And after I remove the quilt, both sheets, no stain is visible, but the smell remains. The cat leaps up to greet it, sniffing carefully, tilting first one nostril toward it, then the other, the way the French will kiss both cheeks of friends. Death is his friend, he tells me, with his lithe dancing through the brush toward a flash of bird. But this is life, he tells me, glinting through the leaves. I'll read one more poem. When I taught at Cleveland State, I used to go a lot to Edgewater Park. And this is also a true story about the one time I saw a swan at Edgewater Park. The swan at Edgewater Park isn't one of your prissy rich people's swans. Wouldn't be at home on some pristine pond. Chooses the whole stinking shoreline, candy wrappers, condoms in its tidal fringe. Prefers to curve its muscular, slightly grubby neck into the body of a great lake, swilling whatever it is swans swill, Chardonnay of algae with bouquet of crud, while Clevelanders walk by saying, look at that big duck. Beauty isn't the point here. Of course the swan is beautiful, but not like Laurie at 16 when everything was possible. No, more like Laurie at 27, smoking away her days off in her dirty kitchen, her kid with asthma watching TV, the boyfriend who doesn't know yet she's gonna leave him washing his car out back, and he's a runty little guy and drinks too much, and it's not his kid anyway, but he loves her. He really does. He loves them both. That's the kind of swan this is.
It's the poetry of Ruth L. Schwartz. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jan.
Great to have you here. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have the work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.